Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. We've got a great panel coming up on This Week in Law. Evan Brown is with me, of course. And we've got Intel's Peter Biddle and Cypher Law Group's Jim Denaro. We're going to talk about locking things up, opening them up, lots about DRM and DRM standards. We'll talk a little bit more about the Xbox One, Chinese hackers, patent reform, and lots more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown. Episode 213, recorded May 31st, 2013. Fun like Death Valley. Hello, and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, and we've got a fantastic panel of folks today with us. I'm really excited about this show because we've got one of the world's great specialists in DRM and all the issues around it, and a really great specialist in cybersecurity. So we're going to be talking about locking things up and freeing them a lot today. Let's get right to that. Our DRM person I was referring to is Peter Biddle, who is the general manager for the cloud services platform at Intel and has been thinking about DRM and other related issues for quite some time, over a decade now. And it's great to see you again, Peter.
Hey, it is really nice to see you again as well.
Also joining us from the Cypher Law Group is Jim Denaro. Hello, Jim.
Hi, great to see you. Thanks for having me.
Great to see you too. Lots of security stuff going on this week, huh?
Absolutely. It's nonstop.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment as soon as we also introduce my co-host, Evan Brown from Chicago, Illinois, and the InfoLaw Group. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Happy Friday. Hope everything's going well with you. It's great to be here.
It's great to see you too. And yes, thank you. Everything is going wonderfully on this Friday. Thrilled to be here for This Week in Law. I think we'll start out with some DRM issues and take a look at the copyright arena. So, Peter, you and I first met at a Digital ID World conference in Colorado over a decade ago, very shortly after your darknet paper came out, I think. Can you tell us a bit about that paper for people who are not familiar with it and its impact?
There's short answers and long answers. I'll try to do an in-between answer. Yeah, and I'm sitting here bridling at being the DRM guy on this, show.
Yes, tell us why you're bridling.
So, in the late 90s, we were working on making Windows a more secure operating system to make it more capable playing back encrypted content. This came out of work I had been doing around the DVD standard and getting DVD launched as a standard or as a format. That was my job at Microsoft. I was sort of the DVD guy and the media guy and became the content protection guy. And during that process, you know, we went through some transformational thinking. And by the late 90s, I had sent out this piece of email internally that I called the five rules of the subnet, because we were calling it the subnet back then. And rule number one was something along the lines of, from now on, you'll always compete with your own stolen product. And that sort of became very formative thinking for us when we were thinking about what is increased security actually really good for on openly programmable devices or field programmable devices, which PCs were back then, at least. One of the conclusions out of that was that DRM as a construct had some interesting attributes around the security model, but that it didn't actually work for user consumable mass market goods from a stopping or preventing privacy perspective, because there will always be leakage if people can watch the thing or listen to the thing. And if there is leakage, then the leakage will wind up transmitted around the world in what we called the dark net. And that became a paper in 2002, which we published, which, you know, was, we thought, just stating things that were fact and science, but among other things was kind of unpopular when in some venues, when we're in charge of trustworthy computing at Microsoft, I had the trustworthy computing engineering team working for me. We were supposedly trying to make DRM and lock down PCs and make them not work and kowtow to Hollywood, when at the time, you know, the sort of strategic thinkers and the architects on the project were saying, actually, this will never work to stop piracy. So 2002 is when we published that paper, and you and I met at Digital Identity World shortly thereafter, during sort of the maelstrom of energy around that paper, as well as trustworthy computing or treacherous computing and digital rights or restrictions, depending on who you talk to. And that debate really came to the fore.
Is it funny to you to look back over the concerns that were floating around about your paper and the points that you made, and the architecture that Microsoft was working on at that point, and look at where computing has gone in the ensuing 10 plus years, and how we've moved now more toward that world where things are more locked down and less accessible by the users? You know, the Apple iPad being a great example.
Yeah. It's funny, kind of like how getting a flat tire and running out of gas in Death Valley with no water is funny.
Right.
In the sense that, God, if you just let us do what we wanted to do, oh, it would have been so great.
How would it have been really different? Well, map that out for us.
We were working to build what I call a technically neutral and unbiased platform, a platform capable of enforcing the rights that are demanded by a combination of the user and the software running on that system. And there was not, and it never had been, and is architecturally impossible, any model that said that there was going to be some kind of super monitor in the machine that would actually grant permissions or deny or allow permissions to software to run. And what we basically, you know, our model said that we'll run any software and we'll protect that software from all other software. If you contrast that to sort of, you know, modern walled garden security models and business models and sort of the whole notion of platform lockdown, it's kind of not even apples and oranges. It's like apples and cinder blocks comparison. Because you know, people are locking platforms down and not allowing software, arbitrary software, to run based on wanting to, you know, be successful with their business model, which is great, you know, and all the power to them. If we had gotten, I think if we'd gotten something out there and used, and there's lots of reasons it could have failed, you know, just commercial product fails all the time. But if we'd gotten something out there and gotten it used in a sort of general purpose way, it would have meant that things like, you know, Nadeem Kobayashi's, whatever that crypto cat thing is, could have been way better. Tor could have been way better. Would movie studios have had ways to keep movies from being stolen directly off of your desktop of your PC? Yeah, they would have been more effective. Would they have stopped distribution of stolen content? Absolutely not, because there are all sorts of ways to hack it, including hacking the hardware or just sticking a camera at the screen. And it really would have been pretty, I think, interesting, an alternate future to have had general purpose hardware and general purpose software that was capable of creating a partition that is under, you know, control of the software that created it and that can do anything inside that partition it wants, but is universally protected from everybody, including Microsoft and bad guys and good guys, all at the same time. That would have been a really interesting, different universe.
Do you think it's too late at this point for a strategy like that, for Microsoft or Apple or somebody else to come along and decide, okay, we've tried all these other models and they're broken in their own way. Let's try what Peter and his team were talking about in 2002.
Well, I don't know that there's any commercial incentive to do that for the people who are the incumbents now. If you look at, you know, you look at what Apple wants and what's their business model. Their business model is to have more boots going through more store doors, you know, more basically more people in more stores to buy more hardware. If you look at when Apple has embraced DRM, which they have, and were clearly at one time the world's largest progenitor of DRM, and then when they've turned their back on it, it's been entirely on when it's best for their hardware business model, right? They basically gave up on DRM or started to walk away from DRM when they had total domination of the iPod market and when DRM became a liability as opposed to an asset because they were no longer in a growth business. They were now in a defender business. And the same is true for Microsoft. The same is true for, you know, for anybody who's playing in the cybersecurity, DRM, content protection, et cetera, space. You know, a lot of the stuff that's built into platforms is there because the platform relies on a business model, and that business model either benefits from or does not benefit from tighter restrictions on what users can do on their systems. So, I mean, I don't think that the pendulum is permanently swung more towards walled garden, closed device, you know, console kind of universes. But it certainly is pretty far along that route now. I think that it'll start to pivot back out when, you know, enough people get fed up enough with not being able to do stuff.
Peter, your comments about the business model are very interesting, and I see an interesting sort of conflict now with how encryption is being used. We're going to talk later about the W3C encryption and DRM technology that's coming out that looks like it's probably going to be in the standard. But when you look at how these companies like Google, for example, are using encryption, it's inconsistent. For example, I was posing the question online a few weeks ago, why is it that there's no really good way to do encryption in Gmail built in? You know, you've got to run this or that plugin or just cut and paste it even if you have to. And somebody pointed out, I think, rightly so, that, well, then Google couldn't read your email. I mean, if everybody encrypted everything end to end, that would be a business model problem for them. So you're probably unlikely to see that technology come out in the web browser or even in Android in the Gmail application. So that's third parties. But you also will see Google supporting the W3C initiative to support DRM and encryption there because that's of course, consistent with the business model.
Yeah, no, I total agreement. I mean, 97% of Google's revenue still comes from paid search and advertising. Their CPC went from 48% to 40% in 2011. That means they're getting depending on who you talk to, can move less than half of their ad inventory right now, even though they're still minting money in that business. And that means that they need more contextually relevant ads in more places going forward than they do now. So contextual relevancy is all about knowing your users really intimately, or our users, or us really intimately, and then getting us ads that have a higher CPC than what you could get otherwise, and also putting those ads in more places. Another place, you know, an interesting place to look in the intersection of sort of policy, security restrictions, et cetera, is now in location where, there's a clear desire on the part of the location providers to start treating POIs, points of interest, as monetizable events, as ads themselves, because they have a much higher potential bounty or CPC. And you can imagine that, you know, people, the providers in that space, the dominant providers, will embrace security if it helps them entrench usage and, you know, make switching costs go up to go from one location provider to another. But also they will not want security where it might affect their ability to be contextually relevant, which is clearly what Gmail is all about, right? They're not doing Gmail because they're nice.
Well, mostly. Let's look at the dark net itself 10 years down the road. There's so much more information, so much more copyrighted material that is available on the web, whether DRM'd or otherwise. How do you think, Peter, the darknet has changed since when you wrote the paper?
I think this is one area where we where I'm most proud of the work we did, because you know, we basically mapped out, okay, what are all the attack points? I mean, we were a bunch of both security professionals as well as hackers, and we said, okay, so let's map out every possible choke point in the distribution stream between when, you know, light turns into an electronic record or vibrating molecules, air molecules become sound, and then when they're consumed, and let's figure out how we would try to lock that up, and then let's figure out how we would try to destroy those locks. And you know, a lot of things have come that's you know, the basically what we looked at in the paper has come is what's happened, right? So people have tried to restrict what's on the internet itself. People have tried to restrict the namespace. So namespace is how you discover both people who have things as well as the things themselves. People have tried to control clients. People have tried to shut down clients. People have tried to shut down network access. All of those things are things that have happened since we wrote the paper. Now, you know, getting access to content online, it's gotten easier and easier, and at the same time, harder and harder. There's still not a lot of really compelling business case around, you know, exactly how much damage does this do, and does it do any versus a lot. But we are still in a place, you know, we're in a place now, I think, with probably the biggest change is that the huge transformation that's happened with music, because music was taking it on the chin long before, or the old music business models were taking it on the chin long before video and movies were. And the sort of kids, digital natives' view of how they experience and interact with music is radically different from the way I think about how I interact with music. And that is entirely based on both the darknet phenomenon as well as on the commercial responses to that. So things like Spotify and Last.fm and other digital, you know, Pandora, other digital music properties, they you know, the entire notion of even trying those in the late 90s and early 2000s was an anathema to the music industry. And now they're used, you know, as sort of a part of your go-to-market, right? And it does not look to me like there's a lot of professional musicians who are begging on the streets because we're now 10 years into the total erosion or destruction of the old, very limited distribution, highly controlled, constrained, what I call an attention deficit economy, right? A business model of the 70s and 80s. That's basically mostly gone. And yet, you know, there's really good music options now, and there's some really good services that charge for essentially, you know, you can have everything in a convenient, easily consumable way and share it, you know, access to it and talk about it with your friends. And it's better than, you know, than the free options, the free stolen options. That's a great business model, right? It seems to be working really well for, you know, some startups out there and some big tech companies as well.
Peter, so it seems to me like what you're saying is that using Darknet, you can go online, or at least let's say theoretically, in the past you would have gone and used Napster. Perhaps you would have downloaded a bunch of MP3s. The tags might be a mess. Who knows what bitrate they're recorded at. They're certainly, you're probably not going to have cover art or anything like that. Then Apple comes along with the iTunes Store. They put a lot of music in there. It's all going to be really high quality in terms of bit rates and so on. You're going to get to cover art, and it's going to show up on your, you know, really nice little gem of a mobile device, and it's going to just flow nicely. You're going to flip through the covers, and it's going to be great. And now people are willing to pay for that, not because the music experience is any different, but part of because it becomes part of this overall experience that people are willing to pay for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think music and art has always been about the experience, right? People go to concerts not because it's better sounding, it's worse sounding. It's always worse sounding. They go to the concert because, you know, they love the musician, they love the venue, they love, you know, they love that experience. And near as I can tell, that's, you know, that's more important now, way more important now than it was 20 years ago, both from a how do you foster and maintain a great relationship with your fans, as well as how do you maintain financial solvency in light of erosion of potential sales? But the truth is that anybody who is not in the top 100 acts in the world was usually running on loans and in debt anyways, right? So the whole notion of live performances bigger, more important now, because to reinforce your point, because it's part of the experience, it's part of being a fan and loving the music, and I am the kind of person who goes to these concerts, likes this music, I love it, and people are absolutely willing to pay for that. They're willing to pay a ridiculous amount of money for the t-shirt so that they can say they went to the concert, and they're willing to pay for convenience and access and ease of use and being able to share it with their friends. And some segment of the population likes the idea that they don't have to worry or they are legit in the eyes of the owners of those copyrights. And, that's good. Like, that's good. I don't think we'd be where we are now if you hadn't had the pressures that technology brought to bear on that industry, right? I can't see how people would embrace that.
I'm glad that the two of you started talking about concerts and kind of the social, cultural aspect around all of this content, because I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it. And Peter, I wonder if you'd be willing to comment on it from this point, thinking of the dark net as a sociological function in relation to kind of the Lawrence Lessig notion of code being law. I think at least in a certain sense, and there would probably be nits to pick with this characterization, but DRM at a certain level or in a certain way serves to provide that function of technology regulating people's conduct, code being law, in a way that law does not necessarily regulate conduct. And yeah, of course, DRM is backed up by the DMCA, which is an instance of law being law. But what we see with the dark net as a response to DRM and the proliferation of that and the weaknesses that you identified more than 10 years ago, looking at the dark net as a response to that, is there any, or I guess, would you be willing to comment on some kind of assertion that shows that code as law is not really going to be effective in regulating human conduct, because humans, because of the sociological aspect of it and their innate desire to share this content and participate in it by going to concerts, exchanging information with fans, exchanging content with fans, that's really not going to work out as a concept. DRM as a concept in that way is an indicator of a failure of the idea of code as law. What would be your reaction to some assertion like that?
Yeah, so I mean that dates back to, I think there was an EFF position paper in the late 90s that was code as policy, and actually I remember when I first ran into that I was like, God, this is total whack job, and then I was like, actually no, it's not. It's really interesting. I'll turn this on its ear. Rather than code as policy, why don't we think of law as code, right? Law is code. You write the code in plain text, and then you run it through a compiler. But funnily enough, what you try to do, which is actually similar to what you try to do in real code, is future-proof it, because you don't know how the compiler is going to actually deal with the arguments that you're creating in your law, nor do you know if it's going to successfully compile or not, which is to say pass the constitutional test in the United States. The funny thing about law is that there is no standard compiler other than the Supreme Court, and there's a lot of things like case law which constantly changes what an argument that you thought was going to be solid going in one way makes it solid in the wrong direction or a different direction, or turns out that it's really fuzzy. So source code as policy in the sense of it restricts or allows a set of behaviors, I'm actually as much of a more of a believer in that as a model now than I ever was. But in the same sense of context or where code runs, like where behavior runs, you can do all sorts of things in the privacy of your own home, hopefully, and continue to be able to do more of them in the privacy of your own bedroom, for example, that you're not allowed to do on a park bench out in front of a school. And that's because, we're willing to say that the law is going to be contextually relevant and there will be policy, but there are different policies for different places. As long as arbitrary code can run, and as long as it can run on a machine where some number of machines, some reasonable segment of machines, some reasonable segments of a machine of even a machine metaphor, which is changing, by the way, as long as I can run arbitrary code that's, you know, away from the prying eyes of others, then I can exert policy in a way that benefits me as a user and benefits my views of the world. That ceases to be true and that's good, right? I exert my own policy just like I exert my own policy in my living room. When that ceases to be true, that's when, you know, when some of the fears that people like Cory Doctorow and he and I have been like, we have nothing left to fight over because we're in basically violent agreement on nearly everything except for sort of one point. And that is, and I don't even know that we disagree on that. And that is, are the potential network effects of incumbents' ability to control the world too overpowering so that we should be doing things like blocking specific kinds of technology or specific usages of technology because they reinforce the network effects that incumbents can have and where they can spend billions of dollars and entrench themselves versus what plucky rebels, you know, can exert on the system. And as long as arbitrary code can run on a lot of machines, I think we're okay. If we get to a world where everything's a console and arbitrary code can't run, and we have no way to interact with the cloud, for example, or with our own property without it being filtered, spied on, or otherwise analyzed. That's the potential for abuse there, and the network effects of the incumbents being able to sort of dictate what happens. That gets a lot scarier. We're not there, and I'm, you know, a huge supporter of making sure we don't ever get there.
But Peter, it seems to me that the risk of us getting there is increasing rapidly. I mean, if you look at the way bootloaders are locked down on Android and the fact that most people don't know how to root a device or wouldn't have an interest in doing it, even if they could. And obviously Apple, very locked down, even more so with respect to content probably than Android is. And given the fact that the business models of these companies, with probably Microsoft being the big exception, being far less locked down than the other two,
funny,
at least
funny
at this point. Yep.
Irony. Go on.
He said that's funny and it's ironic. Oh. Definitely.
But I'm not that familiar with the Windows App Store, so I can't really speak to that. But it seems like that, you know, the business is going to drive that. I mean, it's really becoming increasingly all about control, and that's where a lot of the value seems to be derived on the platforms, and not leaving it open.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, that the pendulum has gone a long ways since, you know, we were arguing about whether or not Windows was an open or closed operating system compared to
right.
You know,
yeah,
like wide open. You could install your own Ring Zero device driver. You could install your own memory manager. You could jack pages, right? I mean, you could break DMA. You could do whatever you wanted. So yeah, the world has changed, and in fact, you know, there are clearly trends where we are continuing to go towards greater lockdown and higher external control being exerted on devices. There's a few really interesting linchpins. One of the Darknet authors, Paul England, sent me a piece of email after I did a talk called "The Darknet and the Future of Everything" at Gov 2.0, his concern, which I've been thinking a lot about, is if we successfully get to a national ID registration policy, which basically, among other things, says that you have to be an authenticated, validated user by the government or by somebody in order to use the internet, that combined with platform control becomes a very, you know, the ability to restrict behavior or cordon off or monitor behavior is far stronger, right? And there is a possibility that the dark net, as we do understand it now, because today, right now, if you look at what we said was going to happen, it's all happened, and it's still happening. It is interesting to think that if I had to have, you know, what amounts to a national identity, right, and I use that to log into every machine, and I couldn't log into a machine without it. And that would mean that, among other things, my behavior can be tracked and my IP can, right? That potential future universe you know, might actually break the darknet, right? If that were to happen. I actually don't know. I'm still thinking about it. Things like steganography and the cloud might mean that, you know, I can find a data center in Estonia that's not regulated. I can put my own VMs in it. My own VMs can be encrypted and can use, among other things, steganography to hide things in plain sight, and tunneling in order to get access to other services and other resources around the internet that can't be spied on. That's a lot of work that doesn't exist today, and it is way more constrained, right? A lot more control potentially, especially if you know a successor to CISPA passes or there's a requirement to make people use their use a imposed identity scheme in order to log on to the internet.
Okay, I'd like to move this a little bit to the topic of the choice whether to use DRM in the modern world and how DRM can or will be implemented based on certain standards and decisions that may be made at the WC3, as Jim alluded to earlier. So since those tend to impact most Hollywood properties, let's kind of shift gears into thinking about that. So one thing that has, let me back up for a second. We were talking about Apple as being among the most locked down systems out there today, but they were also, getting back to the music point, one of the first to chuck DRM entirely for the commercial MP3s that they were selling. So there is a kind of a conflict there that exists between locking down certain aspects of your business model and deciding that letting things be free is the best business decision in another context. And I'm wondering, you know, I think that every content holder today faces this decision. Peter, you recently said in your interview with Ars Technica about the darknet and your paper 10 years on. Actually, it wasn't that recent. I guess it was last year. But you were talking about Game of Thrones and the fact that it's easier for you as a paying HBO subscriber to forego HBO Go because it has its own problems with bandwidth and availability, you know, that we all experience with streaming. It's not 100% reliable wherever you are, to be able to go to the darknet, download the show that you know that you've already, you know, paid your fees for to HBO and anyone else who's in that chain. And that's just the way you go. That's the way you roll. But not everyone is Peter Biddle. Not everyone, you know, is willing to install a BitTorrent client and take that step. So a lot, I think, of rank and file America are willing to say, well, you know, it's available to me, I've paid for it, and yeah, the streaming kind of sucks, but sometime it'll work and I'll be able to watch the show even if I missed it when it aired. So I'm thinking of DRM, and I think that content owners probably think of it as a speed bump, that, you know, it's going to deter a sufficient amount of people that we should continue using it and finding creative ways to implement it. And I think that's what the Associated Press tried to do when it decided, okay, we're going to have this licensing scenario where we're going to be able to work with bloggers and make sure that they're licensing things that they're using from news-related content. This was called Newsrite, and it was announced. And then, as reported recently, nothing happened with it. And in fact, it is entirely shut down. Their whole DRM arrangement for this news content, who's to say that they've actually abandoned it? The AP issued a press release saying, you know, these properties are going to go to other parties and we're not going to administer it anymore. So it may come back in some other form. But there was a DRM universe that someone thought was a good idea and then abandoned. I think that this you know, happens over and over as content owners struggle with this. And I'm wondering, Peter, where you think we are with that decision-making process? What do you think the future of DRM is?
So Future of DRM. If everybody in the value chain or the majority of the people in the value chain were happy with stopping at speed bumps, it would, you can come to some good compromises if everybody was happy with stopping at speed bumps. But in my experience, people frequently aren't, right? If you can solve the speed bumps, then you're looking at, okay, what can we fix next? What's broken for our business model that we want to fix, that we want to use a combination of technology and policy in order to fix going forward? I definitely think that there is clearly a driving, there's energy in getting DRM deeper into, or more standardized and out in the universe, for example, with the W3C stuff. On closed platforms, the whole notion of DRM is like, it's kind of the whole platform is restrictive, right? So the idea of, getting movies onto an iPad is a non-trivial thing for a lot of users, including me. When it's not part of sort of the iTunes, getting on there via iTunes. So
there
have been battles. There is still an entire war to wage around how what happens to the user controlled field programmable device. And DRM is an attempt to curtail the ability of users to do field programming of their own device, and thus exert control over what happens on that device. And right now we're still okay, right, as it relates to the balance. I think clearly you can make $1 trillion in a console-based walled garden. There's, nearly a dozen of them. And you can still you can still connect your... You own the root, you own access, and you can get access to basically most or everything with an open or a Windows or Linux PC today. It'll be interesting. I think, go back to what are the main things people are going to go after. They're going to try to shut down the namespaces. So they're doing that. They're going after things like shutting down Pirate Bay and, sending the FBI and New Zealand police into mansions in New Zealand. They're going to try to control what flows over the wires. They're going to try to... shut off access by infringing devices or households or nodes, ultimately they're gonna try to restrict access to anything that would let you potentially sort of work outside of the margins, and that's happening all over the place right now. It's happening in major U.S. and international law. It's happening in the way operating systems are built. It's happening in the way systems are designed and built. It's happening in a bunch of places. That's gonna keep happening.
But Peter, let me start with a premise and then see how some recent developments get your take on some recent developments. So as I see it, DRM is mostly useful for slowing down the spread of illegal copying of whatever the material happens to be, movies, MP3s, and so on. I think. Copyright owners are willing to accept there will be a certain amount of loss, and some people will copy. But as long as it's made sufficiently challenging, then that's okay. As long as you've got to go into some less convenient form, maybe you go onto BitTorrent, you got to find the files, and then of course your IP is exposed to the public at that point. And occasionally, especially in the context of porn. People do get sued in federal court for those downloads. So there's a risk that you might not want to take in getting this content through these other channels. So maybe that's enough. But the interesting recent development that we've seen is happening on to the news groups, a forum that you mentioned in your Gov 2.0 LA talk. It used to be that, and this is getting some more press in the blogs as well over the last few months, it used to be on Usenet that everyone could just upload anything they want to the binaries, and everyone could download everything. It usually had high speed, and this was a very popular form for all kinds of content. But then recently we've seen pretty much all the news feeds have been hit by DMCA takedowns. And it seems to me that the reason why that's happened is this format for exchanging copyrighted material has just gotten too popular. And it actually started to pose a threat. It wasn't just a few people anymore. It became too easy. They're just the news clients are just too sophisticated. And then now that brought the attention of the copyright owners. And now they've essentially automated the process of doing DMCA takedowns in that form.
Go ahead, answer, Peter, but then I want to inject a new topic here.
That's essentially a namespace attack, right? That's making it harder for me to find the bits rather than attacking the bits themselves in a way. Although, you know, Usenet is essentially a kind of slow, weird, self, you know, replicating bit distribution network. One of the separate but very important parallel thing that's been happening is the dumbification of hacking has meant that that technology has made it easier and easier for people to create both exploits so that they can try to hurl at other people's machines and other people, but that the ability to actually create good security has gotten better and better as well. And taking that as an example, the notion of being able to use a combination of a bunch of strung together, free box.net accounts with encrypted files and hidden using steganography or just encryption. And then, you could do with the same thing that Usenet does that way. But what people are going to try to do is make it hard to discover. I want to get back to the point at the beginning of what you said, and that is that DRM is good is for blah, right? A lot of the what I am seeing and know about happening in the case of people watching pirated content is people watching theatrical films before the films are released in the theater, streamed from sites in Brazil as an example, or in Russia. That's happening a lot, and the ability to shut down that namespace is only as good as your ability to destroy search, right? Because they change the IP addresses, they prop up a site. It's the same site that was up and got taken down yesterday, only it's different with a different name and a different IP address. It's got links to all of the movies that are in the theaters. They're all jigglies shot, by people who went to a studio, a press screening, or saw it in a country that it's opened in when it's not in your country. And you can watch it that way. I know people who, there are people out there who this is how they watch movies. And that's really hard. That's really hard to shut down. You can shut it down. If you keep me from getting to anything but a whitelisted set of URLs, for example, on my device, you could shut that down. But you'd need to break the link between search and search's indexing of the web and content in order to actually destroy, for example, that model.
Okay, the topic I wanted to interject here before we get to the WC3 and other things is Minecraft. Minecraft is less than 2 years old. It is now a $240 million company. And it is a company that has gotten to there by taking a completely different approach to modifications and hacking of the game than all the walled garden console kind of universes have ever taken. And I'm wondering if you guys think, I'm wondering your thoughts on that aspect of Minecraft from both a copyright and a security standpoint. Peter?
I've been tracking and poking around and playing with Minecraft since I think it was in browser only alpha or beta, and it's really cool. I think that getting back to the earlier excellent comment about experience, what Minecraft is like, it's Legos, right? It's Legos for the digital native generations, and as such. That's why it is an experience. It is experiential. It is a way for you to interact with and play with your friends. And that's that is the genius of it, that it is focused on being a better way to interact and play with your friends than commenting on pictures or you know, other things you can do on the internet, forwarding each other cat pictures. The notion of this it being this sort of, you know, this is in some ways what, what was that? It's still up. The Linden Labs thing. Now I'm forgotten the name of it.
Second Life.
Second Life.
Thank you.
Yes.
Right. It's what Second Life
should
have
been. We had to rack
our brains
for that one on the last show, I think.
Yeah. So I think it's what Second Life, it's like Second Life 10, 3.0. It's what it should have been. And there's a lot of kids. Like it is very common for me to see at least one comment about somebody's, 15-year or younger kid being in Minecraft a day on my Facebook wall. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are there all the time. That, actually, rather than spend a lot of time thinking about how you could prevent a 14-year-old kid from stealing a TV show they're not watching because they're playing Minecraft, you might want to think about what about Minecraft is so compelling to a 14-year-old kid, and how can I take my position in entertainment and media and tap into being able to, put the ad model or ad dollars or compete in that space, right? Because Minecraft is giving them a better way to experience each other and experience the world than a TV show.
Right. I'm sure there are versions of Minecraft that are being pirated, that there are people out there who do not pay their $25 for that version that lives on your computer. But I've got to think that it's not impacting Minecraft, that Mojang, that they are, getting enough of their initial license fees and then creating this open world, as the parent of one of those avid consumers of all things Minecraft, the universe they have fostered by permitting these mods and giving developer packs that let people decompile and recompile to their heart's content and, create however many alternate versions of Minecraft that the human imagination can support. And they're all out there available to be found. It's very, very compelling. I mean, the kids just love to say, okay, do you have this mod? Do you have this mod? Have you played on this server? It's this crazy, viral, incredibly appealing universe for them. And it's all because Mojang has said, here's our stuff. Play with it as you would like. And I do think that model needs to be having an impact. People need to be looking at that and going, that's really compelling. The thing that is interesting to me about it from a security standpoint, Jim, is the complete lack of security. People are just, here's the thing I made. It's here you go. Download it. Here's how you install it. There is just, no way to really know what you're getting in that kind of an arrangement. But it doesn't really seem to have slowed things down.
Well, not until you hear about some interesting exploits that are being launched through Minecraft and people are playing at work. That would be fun, right? But mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, obviously, the more open things get, the more the security issues come into play. That's just the traditional trade-off: access versus security. So they make it more open and let people do things that may create some risk. I mean, that's sort of what happened with a file format that seemed fairly innocent, Adobe PDF. You can look at a file. It seems fairly inert. I'm just looking at a document. In the original versions, you couldn't even really do, you couldn't edit it even. It's just, that was it, right? Nice. And now that's one of the most popular ways of distributing your exploit is an infected PDF file, because they've added so much, in an effort to, keep adding value as part of the business model of getting people to buy the next version and keep upgrading. More features are added, becomes more open, more extensible, and with that comes that risk.
All right. Well, until people start following the Minecraft model, DRM is definitely a thing that will be part of our lives. The WC3 seems to be recognizing that because it is working with developers like Netflix, who want an HTML5 standard for DRM. This is causing some hand-wringing among folks at the EFF and others. But it seems fairly inevitable. Peter, what's your take on this?
I've been trying to get up in arms about it, and I'm having a hard time getting up in arms about this one. Mm-hmm. I think that it's so much has happened. So what's happening, right? Today, you can watch DRM protected content in like Netflix on Firefox on a browser because Firefox allows Netflix to put the components that they need in order to exert, you know, in order to comply with their DRM requirements that are imposed on them, or they negotiate with the content owners inside that browser. And, I feel kind of like we're saying, you know, like what we're looking at right now is like, it's like 100 meters of distance, and we're arguing about the last half meter, you know, whether or not there's simply a standardized way to say this browser in concert with this web page support interfaces that let there be a black box inside the computing experience that is not under control of anyone but whoever put the black box there, wrote the black box, or created the content. And by the way, that's happening on hundreds of millions of browsers today already. We're just standardizing it. I absolutely get that, but you know, the whole premise of the web has been around this idea that there aren't open source software says that you have to be able to build a competitive, technologically competitive alternative that doesn't require that you kowtow to whoever it is that it is, you know, owns that IP and that black box. I guess where I am, and I'd love to hear from you guys is like, okay, so let's do a thought exercise. It passes tomorrow, 5 years from now. How has the world become a worse or better place? People will still be using, you know, Firefox to watch Netflix if they're still around and that still works. People will be doing Hulu and HBO Go, and those are all still going to be true. There's nothing in there that says that I won't be able to go to other web pages, pirate web pages. Like, there's nothing about it that's monitoring or that prevents me from getting content of unknown provenance, you know, AKA stolen. How has the world really changed 5 years from now if that happens? I haven't figured, you know, if you guys has it.
Well, Peter, let me add an interesting parameter, which I don't know if that's been really fully explored yet. What the W3C is doing is they're looking to the future, and they're thinking about the fact that, well, everything's going to be on mobile, right? We just saw that report recently. Desktop sales are, you know, really doing very poorly right now. Mobile sales are up. It's Android. It's Apple. And the point is that on the mobile, you can do DRM using an app. And you know, you can run Netflix app on your mobile device, and you can get DRM protected content streamed to you that way. But that's using a proprietary app. And the point is, well, especially if you're to the WC, I mean, to the average user, maybe the average user just doesn't care. But at least from the W3C's point of view and their interest in staying relevant, I think they want to take the position that no, you don't have to use a proprietary app in order to get this DRM protected content. We're going to provide a means through this community standard for you to accomplish that same goal. So I think, in a sense, it's, and given how important, you know, the ability is to stream media, especially protected media, to mobile devices, and the great demand for that. And you look at, you know, what percentage of bandwidth in the United States is consumed by Netflix on a daily basis. I forget what's the number. It's a huge number, right? But you know, given the importance of that, I think the W3C needs to be able to support this. In order to stay relevant, and then more to your to the thought experiment, I don't see how it's different, because if W3C does not do this, then people will still get DRM protected content. It will just be through a proprietary app instead of through a web browser or through some other more standards based channel. Is one better than the other? You know, who knows? Maybe the apps are actually better. Maybe the apps will have more functionality than you would through a web browser. Who knows?
So, you've convinced me. Right? So I've been trying to get upset about it, and I've been ambivalent. And you've just convinced me that this is one of those things where it's awesome that we have this polarizing debate. That's very good. A lot of goodness comes out of compromise. And I think I based on what you just said, Jim, would say that the notion of being able to ensure that HTML5 and web pages and web apps are competitive with the experiences people get via proprietary apps that live and are distributed by and beholden to walled gardens, that is totally worth having to stop, or that is totally worth the compromise of saying that, you know, we're going to bend a little bit on our ethical or moral or philosophical position around whether or not the web is truly open, because what we're admitting is that the web is great at a bunch of different things, and one of the things it sounds like we want to do is ensure that it continues to be great at distributing content that is currently being distributed under the exact same kind of technological model, but into an environment where choice is already comes pre-reduced, right? And so, yeah, okay. I've now, right now, until somebody convinces me otherwise, I'm now a supporter. I think that I'm going to have to differ with the EFF on this one, and say that I think that ensuring that I can have a great experience with content that would otherwise only be available, or might be best in a proprietary app in a closed environment on an open environment on a open web browser, that's worth it.
I guess one of the concerns is that, and I think market forces would deal with this, is that somebody might choose under this standard to say, okay, we're going to make our DRM'd material available via the web, but in order to access it, you're going to have a particular kind of device or hardware to make that happen. And I have a hard time thinking that a lot of content rights holders would shoot themselves in the foot that way. I think they want to be as many places as they can.
Yeah, I agree with you completely on that. I'd be shocked if anyone was trying to restrict it. But you could imagine a world where there's a tie-in. Where mm-hmm. some Sony, let's just to pick a name, they have a lot of content. They may say, we're mm-hmm. partnering up with Apple, mm-hmm. and only iOS is going to be able to see this stuff. That could happen. That would certainly be a bad result. But that could happen now. I mean, as it is, there's limited availability of certain apps on certain platforms. You can't always run everything everywhere. So right. I'm not sure that that's any different. They could just not have an Apple app or vice versa. For me, I think the bigger issue with the DRM and HTML5 is the risk that it could be used in a way that impairs the fair use of copyrighted material. For example, right now, you see an interesting article, let's say on the Wall Street Journal page, they're already behind a paywall, so they're a good example. They might want to use some DRM built in that's convenient and not heavyweight, where they don't have to, have a special app. You can just see their site. But now you can't cut and paste, because they've managed to use some DRM controls. And that would really be inconvenient, because you'd say, this is a great story. I want to just at least send the headline to my friend. Maybe you can send the headline, but what about the first paragraph? I'd like to send this to my friend with a link to it. Maybe you can't. That would really, I think, people would really be up in arms, I think, at that point, because that's the kind of sharing that everyone thinks is okay and you are legally entitled to do. You're not, sending a copy of a movie to someone. That, to me, is the larger risk if this is adopted in wide use. So this is the right. example you were talking about earlier with the AP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe that's why NewsWrite was abandoned, is they saw this coming down the pipe as something that might enable them to, hey, we see you like to copy that file. Here's the licensing structure or something.
So here's a thought exercise, a legal thought exercise. What if we made a simple but dramatic change to copyright law, and we said that from now on, when your content is born, you have a choice. You can copyright it, at which point you must proactively make it available in all of the ways in which we have grown to expect and are legally required for copyright. So the fair use doctrine takes effect, accessibility, people with disabilities, the ability of libraries to have copies, all of those you have got to actually make happen, not just say you might begrudgingly not sue. Or you can encrypt it, but you can't get both. What if we said that, content that is born encrypted is not copyrighted?
Content that is born encrypted is not copyrighted.
So you can rely on the technology to protect your content, mm-hmm. or you can rely on the law to protect your content. But you can't, you don't get to pick and choose. So you don't get to say, you don't get to say, I am going to actually rely on copyright to protect my content if it ever gets broken out of the encryption it's in, but I'm going to encrypt it and then use policy to enforce a set of restrictions that are actually less than what copyright mandates must be allowed. Right? I'm going to use.
Yeah. It seems like the content owners would then insist, something very contrary to what a lot of people want today. A lot of people want the provisions, the anti-circumvention provisions weakened, you know, Section 1201, mm-hmm. Section 1202 weakened. If the alternative were, that new form of protection and conversely that new form of liability that came into existence in 1998, the world had never seen anything like what is in the anti-circumvention provisions in Section 1201 before 1998, this idea that you could be liable for breaking DRM, I mean, that's something that's very, very different than what we'd want now. And it seems like the content industry would insist upon that if they really get one shot at protecting this. Because as you, Peter, better than anybody on the face of the planet has observed, once
right.
that weakest link in the chain is broken, it's out there. And under this system that you're talking about there, it's out there for good and there's no remedy left. So it would seem like it would maybe work an exact, kind of the unintended consequence would be, greater strengthening of Section 1201. That's what the lobbyist would want.
Yeah, actually, I think that's you might be right. I think that an unintended, or depending on your perspective, intended consequence would be that people retake a look at just how much encryption do they actually want to use and how much does their business model rely on restricted access to information versus, a more forward-looking view because, copyright actually has a lot of attributes to it that are good, right? There's some good law there. I think that the reason I've been thinking about it this way is that we voluntarily as citizens of countries that honor copyright and have that law say that we are not going to, we're not going to do things and we're going to accept sort of certain restrictions on behavior as well as the potential legal repercussions of messing with copyright in exchange for it's a social and a legal contract, a set of things that are allowed. And getting back to the very earlier conversation around source code being policy, if source code is policy, then what's happening maybe is that by creating a less than copyright digital rights management distribution mechanism, you're rewriting the contract out from underneath us, right? You're making it so that there isn't accessibility, the libraries aren't okay, you don't get fair use, you can't make copies, you can't enjoy it on a different device, you can't make backup copies, all of which are precedents that have been covered under things like the Betamax case, etc. So that seems like we're rewriting law right now in some ways by saying that you can get all of the benefits of copyright and none of the obligations. You can get the benefits of copyright by just slapping a copyright notice on it and then duck out of the obligations by encrypting.
Well, and we all got hooked on what you said at the second part of what you were saying there. If it ain't encrypted, it ain't copyrighted. And then the first part of what you said, I like that, and that's where I mm-hmm. kind of thought you were going with all this to kind of take us back to the pre-January 1, 1978 copyright system where you don't have a copyright interest to enforce unless you undertake certain formalities and affirmatively register the work with the Copyright Office. I think there might be some problems with some international treaties at this point to take United States copyright back to that under the 1909 Act, that kind of system there. But it seems like it would make good public policy sense that if the copyright interest means so much to you, then you ought to be able to do something to ensure that those rights are there rather than the terminology you're using, Peter, which is apt. You don't even have to slap a copyright notice on it. You can just create it, release it, and then run away from all those obligations of being a copyright owner until the day that you want to enforce those, whether it be through infringement or an anti-circumvention action or something like that. I think there would be a lot of benefit in putting more of the onus on the copyright holder, the creator, author, copyright holder, copyright claimant to actually do something if it means all that much. Otherwise, it should be out there more presumed to be in the public domain, more maybe if not in the public domain, maybe a stronger presumption that its use, its remix, its incorporation into a derivative work is going to be a permissible fair use. So I really like the first part of what you were saying. The second part is like, well, it's a little bit too bizarre to just kind of, you know, let it marinate into your brain to think about it in a short period of time. Have to meditate on that a little bit.
Yes. And I'm so taken with this thought experiment and the rest of our discussion today that I haven't yet put into the show an MCLE passphrase for anybody who may be listening for professional credit, either in the legal or some other field. So let's go ahead and do that. And we'll make it EME, which stand just the letters EME, which stands for Encrypted Media Extensions, which is the proposed DRM standard that the W3C has been working on. Does anybody want to talk about DRM and the Xbox? We had Kyle Orland on last week and talked a little bit about this one thing that I thought it would be fun to bring up with you, Peter, and that's the notion of DRM moving away from some sort of coded lock to a camera. Visual DRM, as the headline of this one article we have calls it, where the Kinect looks at you and decides how many people are in the room. And this is something that Microsoft has patented and has not said they're going to roll out as part of the Xbox One, but it's another fun, well, fun is in the same way getting trapped in Death Valley with no gas is fun thing to think about, whether your Kinect is going to be looking around the room and going, this movie's licensed to have 6 people watching, you have 10. So a little message maybe would pop up and say, you know, cough up some of your Xbox Live credits to continue watching. What do you think about that?
So I was in a conversation. This was in the Secure Digital Music Initiative, SDMI, which was an ill-fated attempt to do for music and DRM what had been done in the CPTWG for DVD and movies. And at the time, this was during the whole Metallica suing their fans, right? That was the headline. And, you know, I was in a working session with a bunch of music guys, and I was getting increasingly frustrated. And at one point, I thought in a really ha-ha joking kind of way, said, okay, fine, here's what we'll do. You know, and we have the technology to do it. We'll get together with you, we'll pass a law, and we'll just require that everybody have a neural shunt embedded, you know, at the base of their neck. And it'll close their eyes and shut off their ears at a nerve level if they're looking at content that's been watermarked and they don't have rights to. And one of the guys in the room said, can you do that? And I was like, oh. And nobody said, no, hang on, you know, Biddle, you're insane, you're evil, that's the dumbest thing we've ever heard. People were like, yeah, that sounds like a really good idea. And I thought it was funny then, like Death Valley.
Right.
But yeah, now, hey, welcome to the past and the future now. I think that, again, you're going to, so this is, of the attacks we've talked about, or the ways you want to control and prevent access to stolen content, or make sure that people are abiding by your license model. One of the ways is to control the end nodes, the users themselves, right? And you could, typically we've done this with law, but here we have technology helping us out potentially. It's not that much different, Frank, really, than tracking IP addresses and saying this person's downloading a lot of stuff from BitTorrent, we're going to shut off their IP address. You're just taking, it feels more personal and more icky and more like kind of weird. But it's actually in a lot of ways, I think, quite similar. I think that, again, as long as there's ways to have experiences and interact with things that are outside of that kind of space, I can make a choice between do I like it better inside or outside. I mean, I'm an Xbox Live subscriber. I will admit that I haven't been on Xbox Live because probably 6 months. I was doing a lot of Guild Wars 2, which, by the way, has a model where you buy the game and then they don't charge you for later. I think that if the console model, which is also the device model and the walled garden model, wins, right, and that becomes the only way you can do really high value things for future generations, then the big concern I have is actually around the same thing we saw with music in the 50s and the 60s, and that is that successful restriction of distribution, either because the media or the network will only allow certain kinds of distribution, or because you're intentionally doing that in order to constrain awareness to whatever it is you're trying to sell, you know, end of aisle displays writ large. If that, you know, if people are able to do that, then it ultimately absolutely reduces the competitiveness of one artistic work to generate revenue from someone else, right? So that one of the beauties of the internet today is that we're all competing for delighting the same eyeballs and the same ear holes, and we're trying a bunch of different ways to do that. If we get back to a place where there's only a few means to get to those eyeballs and ear holes, you wind up with a lot of derivative works, right? You know, because people only want to do the thing that was just like the last thing that was successful. You don't want to go way out on a limb and invest money or time or energy on something when you have such a constrained environment of distribution. So I think that a natural consequence of what you just described would be 5 years after, you know, if that becomes the prevailing way that people experience media, is there's a lot less variety in media because the market and the eyeballs and the attention will start to get carved up by, you know, by a smaller number of much larger walled gardens.
So, Evan, last week we were talking about Big Brother having the screen on the wall that could watch you. But you're not so concerned about this particular application of the screen watching you being a privacy violation.
Well, I mean, sure, it's at a general level, it's alarming, and certainly if it were used to do some really granular surveillance of users, I would just caution us to be articulate when we're describing what our concern is here, rather than just thinking of Connect's ability to ensure that the number of licensed users has been exceeded, you know, rather than just flying off the handle and thinking that's the worst thing to ever happen to society. Let's just compare that really to an honest answer as to the question of how many people are you going to have in the room? If you tell Microsoft, mm-hmm. we're going to have 10 people in the room, okay, Microsoft knows you have 10 people in the room. And if all that Connect is doing is just evaluating or ascertaining the number of people in the room, that doesn't seem like a big deal. But if it goes any further than that, kind of like, you know, just in the news today, if the IRS wants to ask questions about what a 501c3 is, you know, what its mission and all that stuff is about generally, that's okay. When it gets down to asking pro-life groups, what are the content of your prayers? There's a bounds that needs to be obeyed and not crossed in order for surveillance, government, you know, the party with the power doing too much to invade the space, the province of the users. So I really kind of went down a rabbit hole on that, I recognize. But just kind of recognizing at a fundamental level, the ability to do this, I don't think that in and of itself makes it a privacy violation. We've got to look at what the more nuanced uses of it are.
Well, don't we have just a basic terms of use contract type of issue here? I mean, if you buy the Xbox, it's going to come with whatever the agreement is. And maybe it says that the thing's going to watch you 24/7, and it's going to know all kinds of stuff about you, and it's going to just have a live feed back to Microsoft. That's it. They're just watching you all the time. It doesn't have to be on, right? And they could do that, and you might or might not want to buy it based on your knowledge of that. I mean, if you didn't know that was going to happen, that might be a little bit of a problem. But to the extent, you know, you look at the back of the box maybe and it says, you know, we are watching you. Say, great, sure. That's fine because your content is so amazing, I'm willing to put up with that. But I think it reaches a point where as a society, you might say, no, it's not worth it anymore. You know, either maybe someone else has better content, you go to some other platform, some other console, or you just skip it and do it some other way entirely, or you put a piece of tape over the thing, whatever it happens to be. You know, I think that's the kind of thing that sort of sorts itself out in the end, perhaps. I'm a little more concerned about situations where it relates to an industry standard, perhaps, that people have to use. I mean, for example, if the MP3 format required that it turn on the microphone when it was playing the music somehow, that would be a problem because that's the way music has to be distributed effectively. The Xbox just doesn't rise to that level. I think we get into like a kind of gray area when we start talking about things like the App Store or the Android Play Store, because there, yeah, it's not, I mean, you could switch between platforms, but there really are only two. And it's getting to be a little bit more interesting where you the switching costs are high enough that you're not just going to flop back and forth every time you hear about some bad policy. And you already see some peculiar controls coming in. Like, for example, I know on the App Store, on the Apple iTunes Store, there are some serious limitations on the transferability of applications. You know, once you buy an app, you can't just transfer it to your friend, can you? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it seems like you just can't do anything you want with whatever you buy. Or license.
I think there's another piece to this, and that is that increasingly we have no idea who else is listening in. And this as a security concern is actually something that I think is really interesting, because I think it's going to get it's already significantly worse than we're giving it credit for, and it's going to get even worse. And that is that there are things, you know, it sounds paranoid watching us, right? But there are all the time, and in many cases they are just, that's how the network works. In other cases, they're adversarial, either because they are criminal or legal, and they're about knowing an infinitely scalar wiretap. And again, it sounds kind of crazy, but here's an interesting thing. So, I know what I believe is a fact, but I won't give you any information to prove why, because I can't. And that is that there's a standing policy to not allow NSA employees to have any network-connected device turned on from when they leave their houses to when they get to Fort Meade or the fort. And the reason for that is that there's a concern that the Chinese have actually broken into more than one cell tower in the greater Beltway area. And that would mean that, because they have rooted the cell towers, which, by the way, there was a legal case around Huawei being in those cell towers and there being connections between Huawei and the Chinese government. That means that they can actually, through heuristics and, you know, basically social network graphing, figure out where every NSA employee lives by just tracking their serial numbers and phone numbers as they hop across cell towers. And so this is a concern that our own intelligence agencies are worried about because of the adversarial notion that it represents in, you know, a cybersecurity threat. My experience, having worked in cybersecurity and having shipped cybersecurity products and partnering really closely with three-letter agencies and try to solve problems that they face from a cybersecurity and warfare perspective, is that anything like that is an interesting and potentially scalar adversarial attack on network assets or people or computers or computing devices, anything that you see in that kind of space now you'll see in the mass market, you know, shortly thereafter. And so what does that mean? Well, that means that if we have things that are permanently turned on, we have to trust that to your point, earlier point, right? Okay, so it's my relationship with Microsoft, and I have to trust Microsoft, and maybe that's good enough for me. But what if Microsoft had a security hole in there they didn't know about, and that meant that a bunch of other people could be on there too? Or what if they're broadcasting across a network and they're doing it in an unsecured way? What if they've got a presidential letter that says that they have to be giving raw dumps of all of those video feeds to the NSA, just like there are presidential letters for the telco networks and a bunch of other networks already? What if, right? How do I agree to that contract when I actually don't know who's on the line?
Right. And I've always thought that the Kinect, you know, it's marketed for home and consumer use, but that it is far superior to anything that's used for teleconferencing in the business arena. So, you know, assuming Microsoft ever got on board with that idea and started marketing a commercially, industrially facing product along those lines, then you're problem, Peter, would come right into play and would be, you know, something that we wanted to get to and talk about today, this report of the Chinese government getting into defense contractor networks and copying plans for various aircraft and other things. We talked about this a few shows ago. There was a report from someone called Mandiant, security researchers who found, you know, reported in detail on how this was happening. And now there is the Defense Science Board, a senior advisory group made up of government and civilian experts, finding the same thing. So yeah, this is just another, I'm sure the Chinese would love to have a connect in every conference room, don't you think, Jim?
Yeah, and I think the suspicion is that there's a lot more network infiltration is going on than is really commonly known. And this circles back to what Peter was saying, that you know that you don't know who's on the line. And I think that mm-hmm. is increasingly the case. And you know, we repeatedly, you know, get stories of you know, this system being breached or that system being breached. In this case, it was particularly serious because of the national security implications of the technology that was being exfiltrated, presumably back to China. So it's not a problem that can be easily solved. I think the trick is going to be trying to create a framework where we can try to prevent these things from happening again, or at least not as often, and limit them in some way. And it's just it sort of goes back to a thought that Peter was suggesting earlier, which is, can the law ever keep up with the technology? And I think in the information security space, the risk is most certainly that the law cannot. Even if you could pass a law, could it even keep up? So, you know, for example, I mean, there's CISPA that was attempted and failed, and it may never pass or may pass in a substantially weakened form. So even if you could pass something like that, would it even be effective? You know, typically by the time you pass anything, you know, the technology's already moved on. It's not clear that it's a solvable problem.
Well, let's talk about CISPA for a minute and its status, Jim, since you pay close attention to all of the cybersecurity legislation that's pending. Is this thing completely dead? Because people still seem to be lobbying to pass it.
I mean, there are certain people who seem to be all right with it. I don't know that anyone is really firmly behind it. I think the people who are against it have got probably the weight of the argument right now, and certainly there's more support against it than for it. I think the fact that the White House has promised to veto it, I think, does not help the chances of that being passed. In spite of that, are fairly low. So I don't think anything's going to happen. I think Congress is just too—it's just too much partisan debate. It's too contentious, and I think the stakes are really high. I think it'd be very challenging to draft legislation that really provides enough information sharing to be effective in helping secure networks while not trampling on various important civil liberties. I mean, we see time and time again that in the United States, we would rather be less secure than have more government intrusion. After the bombings in Boston, I haven't heard of bomb detectors being distributed at every public event. Now it's I think people, as a people, we're willing to take that risk in exchange. And right now, that balance is still. That's still the balance, I think, in the information security space. But perhaps over time that will change. We'll have to see.
Okay, thanks for that update. Let's kind of begin to bring the show in for a landing here with a couple of other topics, both sort of policy oriented. One on the patent front. So let's go there first. So as a question of patent policy, Jim, you raised the point for us before the show to think about of whether patents could actually be damaging to cybersecurity. Can you flesh that out for us?
Right. So the idea is that patents provide the patent owner with an exclusive right to do whatever it is that's claimed in the patent. And the sometimes that those claims might be directed to doing something that's relevant to information security. And there actually are some pretty well-known patents out there that cover doing really basic security techniques, such as HTTPS, SSL plus RC4. There's a company out there that has a patent with a very early date, and they've sued essentially every single company that has a secure web browser, that has a secure web connection. That's it. I mean, everyone got sued, hundreds and hundreds of companies over the last few years. So this is sort of a tax that, everyone is having to pay or face, protracted litigation just for being secure. And every now and then you'll see an information security company announces that they've got XYZ patent, and they always tout it as, this technology is critically important for doing cybersecurity, and we have a patent on it. Of course, that's for the benefit of investors and stock prices and so on. But I think there is sort of an interesting public policy question that you get into, where what happens if you get a lot of really important technology that has implications for national security, and especially cybersecurity, which is of increasing importance, and you sort of lock that up and either require payments of fees or you keep it exclusive. I mean, if you're a company that's selling products in this space, you might want to say, no, you can only get this from us. I think there's sort of an inherent tension there between the public need for the technology and the sort of American way, which is that everyone should be free to monetize their intellectual capital.
So how do you think that this would play out, guys? Assuming that there is this threat to cybersecurity from the fact that patents are easily and readily granted, do you think, Peter, that we would see the NSA begin lobbying and taking steps in favor of patent reform?
I don't know. I'll have to think about that one.
we're doing our best to blow up everybody's head today.
I like that. I think that the NSA and other three-letter agencies are there's a constant tension for them between needing to essentially invade personal liberties in order to, in order to sort of do the business of keeping the country secure, and at the same time needing access to technology to prevent other people from doing exactly what they want to do with technology to them, right? And this is why, some of the best defensive security thinking in the world is in places like the NSA and GCHQ/CESG in the UK, because these people have been under adversarial attack, aggressive, incredibly well-funded adversarial attack on open computing networks as well as closed computing networks, copper networks for a decade. I mean, it's been like increasingly war footing for a long time, much longer than really anybody gives it public credit for. And most of the time, in my experience with those guys, they are very pragmatic about, look, we really need, job one is to make sure that our defenses are not destroyed, not, job 1.1 or job 2 might be, we need a way to create, get intel on other people and other things. But we can't do that if we're jeopardized. We can't do that if we are, if we can't trust our own eyes and our own ears, if we can't trust what we're seeing and what we're hearing and what we're interacting with, because our own networks have been compromised, because our own devices have been compromised, that's a catastrophe. So they are very pragmatic about needing really good security, really good policy, really good law to make sure that they can do that. And contrary to sort of way things were in past decades, they're much more open to the idea that that the industry is actually quite good at creating robust security solutions. In fact, better security solutions than if you just let a few scientists come up with something that costs a lot of money and is sort of a custom security thingy that is only available to the intelligence community. They'd much rather use commercial off-the-shelf software and commercial off-the-shelf products that can be used in a highly secure way. So I think, you know, from that perspective, anything that increases the chances that they will have robust, highly secure infrastructure in the future is going to be what they're going to be doubling down on. And anything that threatens that, you can imagine they're going to come out swinging on. Because if they can't trust it, then they can't do their jobs.
All right. Well, thanks for those thoughts. And thanks for also giving me our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, which is going to be custom security thingy. And if you need more information about what I'm talking about here when I'm talking about continuing legal education and the show, head on over to our Twit Wiki. Lawyers will know what I mean, and folks in other professions probably too. And there's some resources there for you if you are needing to get professional credit and thinking that this would be a good way to go about it. Go right ahead. We'd love to hear how you're doing with that, if in fact you're listening to the show not just for pleasure, but to assist in your professional development. We think that's a great thing. Let's move on to the notion of not legalizing, although I think that has to be part of the equation, but regulating security exploits. Jim, again, this is something that you raised. And the first thing I thought when I started trying to wrap my head around it is, okay, so in order to regulate it, it's like cigarettes, alcohol, and various other now narcotic and illegal drugs. You got to legalize it before you can regulate it, right? How are we going to deal with regulating security exploits until they actually become legal?
That's an interesting point. So there's a great examples of things that are regulated, things that weren't regulated and now were not all regulated. So, for example, LSD, right? When LSD was first started becoming popular, it was perfectly legal. It was only once it became more of an interesting public question that it then was added to the schedule and became illegal. So there, I think, you know, this sort of approach, you might see this happen with exploits right now. They're freely traded and they have some societal impact perhaps. They're just no one's really watching the store. And I think all we are is one good exploit sale away from some regulation of this. You know, there are lots of other things that have sort of, perhaps a significant impact on national security are regulated. Arms control, cryptography, for example. You can't export just any kind of crypto device you might have. You need to get a license for that. And you could see the same thing happening for exploits. I mean, right now, if you could do it, you could find a flaw in, let's say, the Chrome web browser, and write an exploit that takes advantage of that, and then use that to gain access to any arbitrary third party out there on the internet that happens to be running that Chrome browser. And this is the way a lot of these intrusions happen. This is the way a lot of confidential information is being exfiltrated from our systems. What's going to happen is someone in the U.S. will inevitably figure out an exploit, and they will sell it to some middle person, whoever that happens to be, and it'll end up in the hands of some, let's say, a distasteful adversary to the U.S. And it'll be used to some negative effect in the U.S. Maybe some harm will come to somebody personally as a result of that, or it might just be a financial crime, or some great state secret will be stolen. As a result of that, I think there will be some more federal attention on this practice that's been going on in sort of a gray black market mostly. And then there will be regulation of that type of information, which is essentially what it is.
All right. I think
causing exploits to go deeper underground would be a catastrophe. I think that, so if you look at what has happened to the Windows operating system and to Microsoft, having started out in a position in the late 90s, and then as attacks became scalar, and as we saw sort of the last of the great worms, and some of the true worms, which are kind of now very hard to actually do at all. It's been a long time since we've seen a real, node hopping worm or Trojan, and the attack landscape has changed. If you go back and you say, okay, so Microsoft used to like really suck at security, and we knew that, right? I was at Microsoft at the time. Microsoft got really freaking good at security because Microsoft was getting, the crap beaten out of it constantly, and the technology needed to improve. And I would actually say, of all the people you could be looking to get security right, do it well, and has a clear, not just financial incentive, but deeply ingrained culture now to do right by and good and a good job with security. It's Microsoft. Some of the best security researchers in the world, phenomenal security response organization, extremely smart security programmers and designers and architects. That happened because here's this globally distributed, hundreds of millions of units operating system that had all these holes in it. All these bad guys start pounding on the holes. Microsoft has to respond, and got better and better and better. And I would hate for us to be in a place where the only people who had access to the exploits are, nation states or the mob or well-funded criminals, because... in that world, I kind of feel like the potential damage is even greater, right? Because you constrain access, the fixes don't get fixed. The fundamental shifts in computing that need to happen to make the fixes, to make the exploits less effective don't happen, and we become more vulnerable.
Yeah, I think what we just need is in an effort to improve the security, some way to incentivize people to do something with the exploit other than sell it to some market, to find a way so that people will be encouraged to sell it either to a vendor or an incentive to publish it. Those are two ways you could make it you could be successful at reducing the risk of them being sold. But otherwise, I mean, I think the financial incentive is sufficient that. It will go to people who have information will probably find a way to get that information to whoever is going to pay the most, in some kind of total balance. So where is that going to be? There are reports. Andy Greenberg at Forbes had a report out almost a year ago where he, at the top end of the spectrum, he had a source that said an exploit could be sold for $250,000, in the right circumstances. And I think it's going to be really hard to motivate someone to do anything with that information, essentially, other than find a place to capture that value. I don't think blogging about it is going to be it.
So here's a funny what I think is a funny observation. Exploits are subject to the darknet just like everything else, and that means that darknet economic forces will affect zero-day distribution just like everything else. What that means is that when I come up with an exploit, say I'm the only person in the world who knows that exploit, up until I sell it to one other person, it has extraordinary value. But as soon as it leaves my control, its value diminishes. The half-life can probably be measured in, minutes, because it's either going to get used as a payload, at which point everybody knows about it, and the industry heals itself quite quickly these days, or gets better at it. There's still work that needs to happen there. I kind of need a darknet for distributing my exploits, because if I tell Microsoft enough about an exploit that's a zero day in Microsoft infrastructure before I sell it to somebody else accidentally because Microsoft has infiltrated my namespace and my network. Microsoft will fix it before the zero day ever gets used by the person I sell it to, at which point it's worth nothing, right? So there's actually this funny network effect in something needing to remain private for a certain amount of time, and then after it's out of my control, I have to assume that its value has essentially gone to zero.
Right, that is definitely one tricky part of the market, how fast it has to move. I mean, even if you found an exploit today, it might just be by coincidence patched tomorrow, because presumably other people may be working on the same type of thing.
All right, guys, this discussion, as has been the whole show, is fascinating, and we could spend a lot of time trying to wrap our heads around the various ins and outs of it, but unfortunately, it's getting to be time when we need to wrap the show, and we have a couple of really good resources I want to get folks from the professional realms that both Peter and Jim are involved in, so I don't want you to miss those. The first is the Cipher Law Legislation Tracker from Jim's firm. And it's a cybersecurity legislation tracker, excuse me. And, if you have questions about, whatever did happen to CISPA and what's its status and what else is pending out there, there's this wonderful chronological tracker on their website at cipherlawgroup.com/legislation that has all the laws that are pending or have been pending recently and their current status. So it's a really nice resource. Thanks for getting that out there for us to use, Jim.
Thank you.
And then also at Intel, I don't think this is Peter's group involved in this, but it's a pretty interesting initiative that Intel Labs folks seem to be partnering up with a lot of other people on something called WeTheData.org, which aims to be a hub of all the folks thinking about big data and all the data about us that is out there and how and who is using it. So it's a great resource and discussion hub on those issues. Peter, are you familiar with this?
Oh, yeah. I think that is out of IXR, Genevieve Bell's organization, and I work with those guys actually really closely, although I wasn't involved in the creation of that site. I think that this is very much part of our view that technical bias is bad and that neutral technology is good. And that's true around data as well as hardware, as well as software. And part of what we're doing there is to really talk about and bring to light the notion of, hey, we want access to data, usage of data, et cetera. We want the technology to be neutral. We want everybody should be able to participate in that economy and be able to access that data and control that data when it's when it's my data. I want to be able to make sure that I'm aware of where that data goes and who might use it and how I'm exposed and I might may or may not want to be exposed. So I think it's cool, and I think you're going to see a lot more around our thinking in this kind of space going forward around, we really like a world in which there are a lot of different choices in platforms and software and services and hardware and devices. And we think a key part of some of those choices ought to be that the technology is neutral. It does whatever the user or the person on that machine wants it to do, it's going to do, and it's going to do well. And we really like a world where that remains, an attribute of at least some of the systems that are available in the mainstream.
The Y section of the We the Data site leads with a quote from CNET that says 92% of children under the age of 2 in the U.S. already have an online profile. So, yes, the data question affects all of us and will affect not just our generation, but the ones to come. So it's great that you guys have done this and are coordinating a nice conversational and thought leader hub around this, Peter. We don't really have a tip of the week this week. We have more of one of our loyal listeners and Twitter tipsters, Totally Fried, who wondered why we haven't done a whole show on cat bearding yet. So we thought instead of a tip, we're just going to show you a nice cat bearding image at the end of the show today and muse about the fact that perhaps that if your own cats are showing up in cat bearding images or the felines that you know, perhaps they should be giving some consideration to their privacy, IP, and publicity rights in the process. So ending on kind of a high and more levity-laden note than some of our topics today, but I've really appreciated the chance to work through all of these with you guys. It's been a really, really interesting show. Peter, great to talk to you again after all this time.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks for having me on.
Our very great pleasure. Do you want to tell us, Peter, folks know where they can find you. I think we've got your Twitter handle up there on the video screen. Obsessed, spelled in a very leet way for anyone who is listening and not watching the show. Anything else you want to plug before we go ahead and wrap up today?
No, it was great. It was great being on. Thanks very much. Keep fighting the good fight.
Thank you. You too. And Jim, great to meet you too. I've been following you on Twitter. You have great thoughts and insights there and in general, and it's fun to get the chance to talk to you.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's been a real pleasure.
And Evan, great to hang out with you as always on a Friday. My Friday's not complete without it.
Hey, same here. I got to admit, I got to go take an aspirin after this. I mean,
I know.
This has to be one of the most, erudite conversations we've had on the show. So this was really great. Really enjoyed talking to you, Peter. Nice to meet you, Jim. So yeah, lots of fun. Thanks, Denise.
Yes, and thank you for all your erudition too, Evan. And folks, when we're not on the air struggling to be erudite, we are, tweeting at our accounts. Evan is at Internet Cases. I'm at D. Howell. We have a Google Plus page for the show and a Facebook page where we post up topics and guests and get your take on what we should be talking about. We get lots of input from folks in those arenas. We'd like to get yours too. If you're listening live, that means you joined us starting at 11 a.m. Pacific, 1800 UTC, which is when we do the show every Friday. If you can't listen live, do check us out on iTunes, YouTube. Our show page is twit.tv/twill, has the entire archive of shows going back into the Paleolithic era when we began this. We're just thrilled that you've joined us today. We hope that you, the audience, have enjoyed it as much as we have being participants here. It's been a really, really fun discussion. And we'll have another one, we hope, next Friday. We hope you join us then. Until then, take care.